I don't understand what's wrong, Sarah, says my mother. We're now back in my room, my mother in her chair, me in my bed. I'm fine, I say. This is great news. It means you're not in medical danger. I know. And you'll see, you'll do much better in your own home.
Uh-huh.
I'm looking forward to saying goodbye to this place. In 3 days, I will have been here for 5 weeks, and I never wanted to stay 1 second longer than I had to. I won't miss this uncomfortable bed, the weak shower, the coarse towels, the bland food, the pervasive smell of hand sanitizer and disinfectant, the gym, the miserable view of the prison, Martha. I especially won't miss the creepy nocturnal hospital sounds that shake me awake and hold me wide-eyed and unsettled every night. The moans of unbearable pain, the panicked and wild shrieking of someone waking from a nightmare, probably reliving whatever gruesome accident precipitated admission here. The coyote wails of the young mother deprived of language and her newborn. The code blue announcement delivered over the intercom carrying their unspoken, chilling message that someone, maybe someone in the next room, maybe someone with a brain injury like mine, has just died. No, I will not miss this place at all. But I imagined leaving on much different terms. According to the scene that I've been directing in my head for weeks, my exodus always went something like this. With joyful tears in everyone's eyes, I would hug and thank each member of my medical team for their role in my full recovery and promise to keep in touch. Then, accompanied by the theme song to Chariots of Fire, and while waving farewell with my left hand, I would walk with confidence and without a cane through the lobby, which would be packed with applauding therapists, physicians, and patients. The staff would be overwhelmed with pride, the patients would be filled with hope, and I'd be an inspiration to everyone. At the end of the lobby, the automatic doors would peel open, and I'd step through into a clear, sunny day, into freedom and my old life. And conveniently forgetting that my car is in a junkyard, I even pictured driving myself home in my Acura. Sitting in my room now, with 3 days left, involuntarily gripping a spoon in my left hand as I wait for Martha to come back with soup, exhausted from the embarrassingly short and granny cane dependent trek down the hallway, I feel beyond ridiculous for ever constructing and then believing in such a far-fetched fantasy. And I'll keep helping you with the therapy, says my mother. This is not an offer or a question. It's an assumption, a foregone conclusion. I stare at her, trying to figure her out. She's wearing black elastic waist pants tucked into black imitation Uggs, a white cable-knit sweater, black-rimmed glasses, dangling red Christmas ornament earrings, and lipstick to match. I can still see the young woman that she was beneath the makeup and old age on her face, but I have no actual sense of what she looked like in between. I remember the shade of peachy pink rouge she used to wear on her freckled cheekbones, her favorite powder green eyeshadow, the wisps of fine hair by her ears that never stayed in her long ponytail, how her nostrils bounced in and out when she laughed, the sparkle in her pale blue eyes, the smell of her lipstick, plus or minus Marlboro Lights and Juicy Fruit gum, that lingered on my mouth after she kissed me. I'm pretty sure she stopped wearing any makeup or doing anything to her hair after Nate drowned. I know there were no more nostril-bouncing laughs and no more smelly kisses. But I have no specific memory of what she looked like or how she changed after 1982. When did she start getting crow's feet? And how does someone get crow's feet if she never laughs or leaves the house? When did her hair begin turning gray? And when did she cut it chin length? When did she start wearing glasses? When did she quit smoking? When did she start wearing lipstick again? And I can't imagine that she has any specific memories of me and what I looked like or how I changed after 1982. She didn't spend even one of the thousands of tedious minutes of the last month sharing nostalgic stories of my childhood, because for the most part, after 1982, she didn't witness my childhood. After burying their only son, my mother then buried herself in her bedroom, and my father buried himself in construction work whenever he wasn't at the firehouse. While my mother did nothing but feel the loss of Nate, my father felt nothing at all. Stoic and emotionally distant before Nate died, now he was emotionally gone for good. But physically, at least, my father eventually came back to his job as my parent. He mowed the lawn and took out the trash. He did the laundry and the grocery shopping. He paid the bills and fees for my after-school activities. I always had food on my plate and a roof over my head. But no part of my mother ever returned, and it was always my mother whom I needed most. She didn't notice if I went to school wearing dirty clothes or clothes that were two sizes too small. She didn't attend my soccer games or parent-teacher conferences. She didn't guide or comfort me through the year and a half that I obsessed and lost myself over Richie Hoffman. She didn't tell me about safe sex or good sex. She forgot my birthday. She didn't praise my perfect report cards or celebrate my admission into Middlebury or Harvard. She preferred to be alone after my father died when I was 20, and she didn't welcome Bob into what was left of our pitiful little family when I was 28. I suppose I resembled Nate enough to be a constantly throbbing reminder of inconsolable grief. I suppose I can understand, especially now having kids of my own, the paralyzing horror of losing a child. But she didn't have one child. She had two, and I didn't die. My childhood after Nate died wasn't easy, but it made me who I am today. Strong, fiercely independent, driven to succeed, determined to matter. I'd managed to put my past behind me, but now my past is sitting in the chair across from me, telling me she's going to be sticking around. She feels me studying her. A nervous smile tiptoes onto her red lips, and I want to slap it off. No, this is it. I'm going home, so you're going home. Everybody's going home. No, I'm staying. I'm staying to help you. I don't need your help. I don't need anyone's help. Martha is now standing in front of me holding a lunch tray, eyebrows raised. If I need anything, I'll ask Bob. Bob asked me to stay and help take care of you, says my mother. I stare at her, voiceless, an unleashed tantrum pounding its fists inside my chest. Martha and Heidi met without me this morning and decided that I'm leaving in 3 days. And Bob and my mother met without me, who knows when, and decided that I need taken care of, and that my mother will be my caretaker. Betrayal and helplessness kick and scream as they sink into the deep, dark layers of my gut, where even having lived there once for years, they don't feel at all at home and can't remember the way out. Since when do you care about me? You haven't cared about me since Nate died. Her face loses all color but for her red lips. Sitting in her chair, her posture assumes a heightened stillness, like a rabbit sensing danger, readying to run for its life. That's not true, she says. I would normally back off. We don't talk about Nate or my childhood. We don't talk about me and her. I would normally choose to say nothing and eat my soup like a good girl. And then she would continue to be the good mother and wipe the broth that will undoubtedly dribble down the left side of my chin. And I would be the good daughter and smile and thank her. But I'm done with this charade. So done. You never helped me with my homework, or boyfriends, or going to college, or planning my wedding. You never helped me with anything. I pause, armed with 1,000 more examples, poised to slay her if she tries to come at me with a reinvented history. I'm here now, she says. Well, I don't want you here now. But Sarah, you're not staying. You need help. Then I'll get it from someone else, just like I've always done. I don't need you. I glare at her, daring her to contradict me, but I've already ended it. She's crying. Martha hands her a box of tissues. My mother blows her nose and dabs her eyes as she continues weeping. I sit and watch her, encouraging her in my unapologetic silence. Good. I'm glad she's crying. I don't feel bad for her. I'm not sorry. She should feel like crying. She should feel sorry. But as much as a part of me wants to see her tarred and feathered in the center of town, I can sustain this tough and heartless stance for only a minute or two, and then I do feel bad for her. She has helped me through the last 5 weeks. She's been here every day. She's helped me to walk and eat, to get showered and dressed, to go to the bathroom. I have needed her, and she is here now. But I can't skip over 30 years of abandonment and just pretend that she chose not to be my mother for most of my life. I can't stand watching her cry anymore, but I'll be damned if I'm apologizing or acquiescing to her plan to stay. We're all done here. I'm going home and back to my life, so she's going back to hers. I grab my granny cane with my right hand, lean on it, and swing my legs over the side of the bed. Where are you going? Asks Martha. I'm going to the bathroom. I say, planting both feet on the floor. Martha moves to stand next to me in the spotter's position. Don't help me. I don't need anyone's help. She pauses, raises her eyebrows at me again, and then backs off and moves out of my way. I realize Martha must be thinking that I'm a spoiled brat and a horrible daughter, but I'm beyond caring what anyone here thinks of me. Well, I care what Heidi thinks of me, but she's not here right now. And right now, I'm a spoiled brat, horrible daughter, who is hell-bent on getting to the bathroom without anyone's help. But walking with a left leg that fades in and out of existence is enormously frustrating and complicated. Even stepping forward with my right foot requires a conscious and continued faith in the existence of my left side. Because when that right foot is in the space between here and there, I'm standing only on my left leg. My left leg and foot have to be appropriately activated, compromising between flexion and extension, responsible for balancing me and holding all my weight upright, a tall order for an appendage that feels no loyalty toward me whatsoever.